So as some of you know, I've been rehabbing my knee since surgery, and the only exercise I can, or the exercise I can most safely do is to ride my stationary bike, which is incredibly boring. So I've been listening to podcasts to try to take my mind off of it. And I've heard some recently from Ezra Klein from the New York Times. Maybe because he's a parent of young children, he's been asking questions that I am wondering about myself these days, about the burden of caring for children and for the elderly, and who is doing that in our country, about the plague of loneliness in our culture, about our isolation from one another in this country. And although he's a journalist, raised as a secular Jew, he is curious enough about organized religion to note when it offers something that we humans need. The practice of Sabbath and rest, for example, the connections with other people, the structure of meaning beyond our own daily lives. And in the recent one, he interviews the author of a book about intentional communities. So everything from monasteries to utopian sort of social experiment groups. All through human history, these different experiments that humans have made with living in extended communities of support beyond the nuclear family. I won't go into the whole conversation. It's interesting. I commend it to you. But I found it especially interesting that they pointed out that although these experiments are often seen as radical, in fact, even right now in our culture, there are two distinct times in our lives when we do tend to live in these kind of extended communities. In young adulthood, when we go to college and live in dorms or share apartments and on into the first few several years of life after college, and old age, when we go into maybe retirement facilities or assisted living communities. But in the long stretch between those two phases of life, when many are working in their careers, maybe raising kids, taking care of aging parents, maybe volunteering in their community in some way, juggling all the combined social and financial stresses of life, we tend to live in the most isolated way possible, in the single family home, and especially in America, in that suburban single family home with the fence around it and the garage door pulled down. And not everybody in this country can or does live in this way, but it's the prevailing image in our media of normal American life. And with that image, the message we hear is that when you're a real adult and you've really made it, you go it alone. You close yourself off from other people and you do your life, complicated though it may be. And we're all supposed to be able to do that as grown-ups. But all the evidence of social sciences lately has been showing us that a lot, perhaps the majority of people in this country, are exhausted, depressed, physically unhealthy, in broken relationships, in debt, overusing alcohol and other substances, as they try to live out this American dream. These intense pressures of life, combined with the isolation that we live in, are damaging so many of us. And yet still we persist in dreaming that dream and thinking that it is somehow the right way to be. Do it all, keep going, don't drop out, and don't ask for help. Because how embarrassing if you can't manage it. We think that we live in a culture without shame. Well, this is where the shame is attached. If you can't do your life the way you're supposed to do it, if you fail to launch at the beginning, those horrible words we give to young adults, or if later you lose your job or your marriage ends or somehow you just can't handle it, what shame. You're supposed to manage, especially if you're in that long stretch of life called being a grown-up. Now, these specific pressures are very distinctly American, but that idea that there is a model of success that we're all supposed to attain that actually is not really attainable, there's been iterations of that throughout human history. Different ideas of what that looks like, but often unattainable to most people. And it shows up right there in our gospel reading today as voiced by the Pharisees, Jesus's favorite critics. In the story, the first thing that happens is Jesus calls one more disciple to come be part of his 12. Not a fisherman this time, it's Matthew, the tax collector, the collaborator with the occupying regime. And then he joins Matthew and all of his tax collector, collaborator, and deadbeat sinner friends for dinner. And right away, here come the Pharisees. Huh. Look at these people that he is keeping company with now. All the people whom we try to avoid. All the people who have totally messed up in life. And he is hanging out with them as if they're worth it. And in response, Jesus says to them, people who are well don't need a physician. People who are doing just fine don't need the healing that I'm here to bring. Only those who are sick and in need God's healing. The messed up ones need me. And right on cue, someone comes up and asks for his healing. And it isn't somebody the Pharisees might have expected to hear it from at all. It's a highly placed official from the synagogue, this fellow Jairus. And he comes right in to the place where Jesus is hanging out with all of these messed up people, and he begs Jesus to come and heal his child, his 12-year-old daughter, who is at the point of death. And this is all in Capernaum, which is Jesus' hometown, so plausibly, Jesus and Jairus know each other well. Perhaps Jesus even knows this girl, and he gets up immediately and goes to head towards Jairus' house. And whatever assumptions we have about what a household in a patriarchal culture would look like, what a father-daughter relationship would look like, clearly this father, Jairus, is desperately his child is beloved. He loves her deeply. And he has done everything he can. No expense has been spared to try to heal her from whatever this illness is. But there she is on her deathbed. And before Jesus can even get to the house, he's interrupted by somebody else. Somebody else who also needs healing. An older woman who is reaching out to take hold of his garments as he passes by. She has needed this healing for 12 years, exactly as long as the girl has been alive. And all that time, she has been an outcast, an unclean pariah on the edge of the community, making it on her own, living desperately on the margins. And who knows what those Pharisees have been saying about her during all these years. And by the way, there's this amazing painting of this encounter in a church in Magdala by the Sea of Galilee. It's a painting just of men's feet and the bottoms of their robes. And then this one lone hand coming in to touch the figure at the center. The woman gets her healing, but not without stopping Jesus in his tracks. His urgent mission to this young girl, totally derailed. But Jesus turns and says to the woman, "Daughter, take heart. Your faith has saved you," and she is healed fully. And then he keeps going to the house. He restores the other daughter in the story to life, and he restores the father from his terror over his child. All three of these people receive Jesus' healing. There's enough to go around. I should say also, my mom used to tell me that she used to hate this story. It pops up in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, because my sister was 12 when she was diagnosed with leukemia, and my mom would pray, and the last thing she wanted was for some old lady with her problems to get in the way of Jesus coming to heal my sister. Now, my sister was healed by a transplant. It gave her 39 more years, and later in life, mom, as an older woman herself, came to have compassion for that woman in her need. We do, over the course of our lives, realize God's grace and healing are not limited in scope. Jesus does have time for everybody that needs him. But the thing is, everyone needs him. The well-protected young girl of privilege, the lonely old woman who is shunned by society, the prominent leader of the synagogue, they all need him. Three different generations of people, three people with widely varying degrees of power in their culture, not one of them able to go it alone and do it all themselves. They need help, and Jesus has it for them. We need what God has to offer. Wealth and prestige, go-it-alone resourcefulness, someone to take care of us. None of us keeps us from needing what God has. No matter what we or our inner Pharisees might think. We try and try to pretend otherwise. But no matter how outwardly successful we are, we all come up to the edges of what we can manage. We get a chilling diagnosis, or someone we love has an accident. Our spouse gets called into the office on Monday morning and finds their job has been eliminated. The landlord sells our building and evicts us. Smoke from wildfires hundreds of miles away gets into our lungs. These aren't hypothetical. These have happened in recent weeks to people I know. We realize that we are not actually in control of any of it, despite what we imagined. We're the ones failing at life. We're messed up, no matter how hard we try. My priest colleague, Rick Fabian, is one of the co-founders of the church St. Gregory of Nyssa out in San Francisco, kind of a wonderful cosmic Episcopal church. And he insisted on carving those words of the Pharisees into the wood of the altar that they built for their church. "This fellow eats with tax collectors and sinners." It was the worst thing they could say about Jesus. And as Rick likes to point out, sinners is a nice translation for what the word really says in Greek. But the Pharisees were right, because that table, this altar, is a welcoming table that Jesus spreads for a meal with all of us. The ones who can't manage it all. The ones who are falling apart. The screw-ups. The ones who need him. In other words, everyone. "I have come to call not the righteous, but sinners Jesus says. I've come to call everybody. Everybody who recognizes that they can't do it all and go it alone. Everyone who hasn't yet figured that out, but probably will sometime soon. All of us are called. And all of us are healed, even in ways we may not recognize right away. There is enough of Jesus' healing for all of us. There is enough to share at the table. And there is so much more where that came from. Amen.